Okay, so the final talk this afternoon, Edward Witten talking on M-theory dynamics on manifolds of G2 holonomy.
So it's actually the same title as the talk I gave in the same room at the David Fest, but it's not really the same talk. It's kind of the continuation of the talk, but I'll make it independent by talking about other aspects of the same work, which is work I've been doing with Mike Latia, as I'll tell you in a moment. However, I will begin for the first 5 minutes with an introduction similar to the introduction I used last time. So, in studying supersymmetric compactifications of string theory, is the microphone working properly?
Yes.
Okay. One of the important issues is the behavior at a singularity. So, for example, there are ADE singularities of a K3 surface, and they give ADE gauge symmetry, which is certainly important in understanding string dualities, and likewise the conifold and other singularities of Calabi-Yau threefolds. And there are a lot of familiar questions that arise in this situation. So a typical question is, what happens in the quantum theory when a singularity develops? Is there extra gauge symmetry, new massless particles? Are there exotic, non-trivial infrared interactions? Are transitions possible to a completely different manifold? And if there are such transitions, do they occur smoothly or via a phase transition to a different branch? Usually the answer depends on physics that occurs near the singularity. So here I've sketched something that might be a Calabi-Yau or it might be a G2 manifold. And somewhere there's a singularity, and supergravity is breaking down near the singularity. What makes this interesting is that if supergravity breaks down everywhere, for example, we scale down the whole size of a G2 manifold in every direction, that's probably too complicated to analyze. And on the other hand, if the manifold is big and smooth, supergravity is valid everywhere. And supergravity is very nice, but after a while that gets dull. So this is an intermediate case where supergravity breaks down because of small curvature, but it breaks down in a localized way so that we can often analyze it. And usually we get an answer that depends only on the physics near the singularity, not on the details of the space-time the singularity is embedded in. Now, the basic singularities are usually conical. When I say that, I don't mean that we'd never study other singularities, but that everything is built out of conical singularities by gluing them together in more complicated ways. So usually one should start by understanding conical singularities. A conical metric looks like this. The metric is dr squared plus r squared d omega squared, where d omega squared is a metric on some smooth manifold M of one less dimension. So all the examples I gave are conical singularities. For example, the ADE singularities are cones on M where M is the quotient of S3 by a finite group. And the conifold is a cone on a certain homogeneous space. So in the Calabi-Yau case, lots has been done on analyzing the behavior at conical singularities. Now, I'm going to be reporting on work with Atiyah on the analogous issues for M-theory compactification on a manifold of G2 holonomy. So the question is, what happens in M-theory when a G2 manifold X develops an isolated conical singularity? So there's been quite a bit of previous work, which actually has been, moreover, reported just now by Acharya and yesterday by Aganajic and Vafa. So you've heard a lot about it, and my talk will overlap with something of what you've heard. Now, there are several examples known. There are basically three examples known plus their orbifolds. There probably, I might say, are many more examples that exist, but they're hard to find because G2 holonomy is a nonlinear equation. If you want to study a singularity of a Calabi-Yau manifold, there's no trouble to describe possible singularities. You just write down some naive equation. Well, this is the most naive version. There are more sophisticated versions. But to begin with, to at least get a bunch of examples, you just write down an equation. And then what remains is to study it. But for G2, it's a little bit different. Here we use the fact that the Cauchy-Riemann equations are linear, so we can describe a complex manifold just by writing down an equation. But G2 is completely nonlinear, so it's hard to find the examples. And after finding them, then you'd want to study them. So the known examples are three plus their orbifolds. And Although we've investigated all three, at the David Fest I mainly talked about the first two examples, so I'm going to concentrate on the third one today, which happens to be the one that figured in the other lectures. So I'll focus on what seems to be the most subtle example in some ways, which is the case that our G2 manifold is a cone on a product of two three-spheres, or a quotient of that. Now, the product of two three-spheres, we could also call it SU2 times SU2, because a three-sphere is the group manifold of SU2. It's got an obvious Einstein metric. We need Einstein metrics here because to get a cone to be Einstein, and G2 is Einstein, this guy here has to be Einstein with positive cosmological constant. In fact, the cosmological constant has to have a certain value, roughly speaking, 2. But, so we need an Einstein metric on S3 times S3, and there's an obvious one, which is the product of the two round metrics on the two three-spheres. And that gives an Einstein metric on the cone, but it doesn't have G2 holonomy. There's a less obvious Einstein metric on S3 times S3. To find it, we regard SU2 times SU2 as a homogeneous space SU2 cubed divided by SU2, where SU2 acts on the right on all three factors. So we take three elements of SU2, and we identify them under right multiplication by a fixed element H. If we look at, so this space is equivalent to SU2 times SU2, because I could use H to gauge away any of the three Gs. And that's often useful, but one has to bear in mind that there's an obvious symmetry of permutations of the three Gs that's lost if you use the H symmetry to gauge away one of the Gs. So the symmetry, which is obvious in this way of writing it, is a triality group, sigma 3, which permutes G1, G2, and G3, as well as the three SU2s acting on the left. So this is a symmetry group that S3 times S3 can have. It's different from the symmetry group of the obvious Einstein metric. But there's a unique Einstein metric on this space that has that symmetry group. It's actually very easy to find for the following reason. If you just ask for some metric that has this symmetry group, first of all, it exists, because you can take any metric and average over the action of a compact group. So since this group is compact, there's an invariant metric. And if you look a little more closely, you find here that the invariant metric is unique up to scaling. Well, the Ricci tensor has the same symmetries as the metric tensor. So the uniqueness means that the Ricci tensor is a multiple of the Einstein of the metric. And therefore, if you scale the metric correctly, you get an Einstein metric of any scalar curvature you want. And if you take S3 times S3 with that Einstein metric, then the cone on it has G2 holonomy. So Y was S3 times S3 with that Einstein metric. A cone on Y has a singular metric of G2 holonomy, where the singularity is because at R equals 0, this thing has a conical singularity. Now, that's interesting, but it's also interesting to ask if it can be deformed to a smooth manifold of G2 holonomy. And there are three ways to do this. I should say that both the cone metric and the smooth one I'm about to describe were found around 1990 by Bryant and Salomon. These references have already been mentioned, but anyway, they were found by Bryant and Salomon and Gibbons, Pope, and Page. Well, there actually are three ways to deform this cone to a smooth manifold of G2 holonomy. So there are three manifolds, which I call Xi, I equals 1, 2, or 3, that all have G2 holonomy. To make the ith manifold, you see, so far each of the G's lived in SU2, which was the same as S3. But now we let one of the G's live in R4 instead of S3. Think of S3 as the unit sphere in R4. And just relax the condition that G is a unit vector on the 3 sphere. That doesn't mess up any of the symmetries. It doesn't mess up the SU2 symmetries. Of course, if we pick one of the G's and say that it lives in R4, it does mess up the triality symmetry. So, for example, if G1 lives in R4 and G2 lives in S3, we gauge away G3 using this symmetry, and therefore we find that our manifold topologically is R4 times S3, where G1 parameterizes R4, G2 lives in S3, and we got rid of G3. So we can make three manifolds here because we could fill in any one of the G's. So, of course, this breaks the permutation group of three objects down to the permutations of two objects, namely the ones we didn't fill in. And Xi are permuted by the broken symmetry, sigma 3. Now, the only modulus of a classical G2 metric, to be more exact, a G2 metric on X that's supposed to be asymptotic to the cone that I already told you about. If we look for a G2 metric that's asymptotic to the metric I told you about on the cone, then it has only one real modulus, which is the volume of the S3 at its center. So the topology, it's analogous to Clavielle's, where there could be an S2 or an S3 that shrinks at a singularity, and it has a volume, which is an important modulus in one of those problems. So here, the volume of this S3 is a real modulus, which is the only modulus of the Einstein equations on this manifold, for those boundary conditions, that the metric should look like a cone at infinity. However, we now have the magic of supersymmetry, which says that the parameters are really complex. In string theory, this real modulus combines with a period of the C field, the M-theory three-form field C, integrated over S3, to make a complex parameter that I'll call phi, which is like a chiral superfield, but it has the important property of being non-dynamical, so it's more like a coupling than a four-dimensional field. Perhaps, rather than a chiral superfield, I should compare it more to the coupling parameter in gauge theories, which couples like a chiral superfield, but it's usually thought of as a coupling constant. I should say it enters the Lagrangian where a chiral superfield would, or in the same way. But it's usually thought of as a coupling constant because you could make it dynamical by adding an extra field, but usually in gauge theories it's just a coupling parameter. So similarly, phi is non-dynamical because, for example, fluctuations in the volume of the S3 are given by a zero mode of the Einstein equations that isn't square integrable. And therefore, there's an infinite kinetic energy in those fluctuations. Now, let's take a small digression and recall a familiar story in type 2A, which is the Carnot-Fold singularity, given by this very simple equation where the Zi are complex variables. So there are a variety of things we can do with this singularity, of which two are important for the moment. We can move in complex structure moduli space and deform it. That just means we write a different equation, a slightly different equation. We add a small constant epsilon to the equation. And while this describes a singularity where all the z's vanish, this describes a smooth manifold in which the singularity is replaced by a three-sphere. If you assume epsilon is real and positive, the three-sphere is just given by taking all the z's to be real. Obviously, if the z's are all real, that gives you a three-sphere whose radius is the square root of epsilon. And so if epsilon is a small parameter, there's no singularity, but there's a very small three-sphere whose radius is the modulus, or at least the absolute value of the modulus of this problem. Now, although this is called moving in complex structure moduli space, though it takes longer to write equations, you can also move in Kähler moduli space, in which case you replace the singularity by an S2. There actually are two ways to do this, which are called small resolutions, and they're separated by a flop, which is a smooth transition in conformal field theory. So you can write equations, but it takes longer, so I won't. So the picture looks like this. In the interior, classically, there was a singularity. You can make a small resolution in either of two ways that gives a conformal field theory moduli space. The conformal field theory moduli space has a singularity at one point where the radius is near zero and the theta angle is also zero. And at that point, a wrapped brain becomes massless, and that's where the famous conifold transition occurs to the other branch, which corresponds to the deformation. So this is a familiar picture without Ramon-Ramon flux. If we turn on Ramon-Ramon flux on the S2, we can observe that its effects are infinitesimal in the conformal field theory limit. They're proportional to G string. And the property of something being smooth is always stable under small perturbations. Being singular is not stable under small perturbations. I wrote down a moment ago a singularity that could be removed by an arbitrarily small perturbation epsilon. But if something is already smooth, a sufficiently small perturbation of it is still smooth. So having a smooth transition between the two small resolutions is inherently stable, and therefore if it's true without Ramon-Ramon flux, it's still true with very small Ramon-Ramon flux. But the assertion that there's a singular, that you have to go through a phase transition to go from one branch to another, is potentially unstable, and in principle either of two things might happen. Under a small perturbation, they might disconnect, or they might become smoothly connected, or the picture might remain the same. Now, the reason I've reviewed this situation for the conifold is that, as has actually been explained in the lectures yesterday afternoon, the three G2 manifolds X are related to these three. We had three manifolds, and there were three things that can happen in type 2A. There are two small resolutions, and there's one complex structure deformation. And those three possibilities in type 2A correspond to the three manifolds. In going from M theory to type 2A, you break the symmetry by taking some direction and regarding it as the M theory circle. And after breaking the symmetry that way, the three manifolds get interpreted differently. So even though this has already been explained, I'll go over it briefly. To get from M theory to type 2A, you divide by U1 in, for example, the first SU2. And then if you're on X1, so that G1 has been filled in, you gauge away G3, so G2 parameterizes in S3, G1 parameterizes in R4. U1 is acting on G1, and now the usual correspondence of the Klutze-Klein monopole to the type 2A 6 plane tells us that the quotient is going to be that R4 is replaced by R3, but there's a D6 plane at the origin of R3 times S3. So in this fashion, X1 is related to type 2A with a wrapped brain. And on the other hand, as it was also explained yesterday, if you, on X2 or X3, where G2 or G3 is filled in, you gauge away the other one. And so G1 parameterizes in S3, and U1 acts on the S3. And now the quotient is S2 times R4, which is the right topology for the small resolution. And if you look at this more closely, it's a twisted bundle, so you get the Ramon-Ramon flux. So actually, at the David Fest, I explained some other quotients by U1, both for this example and for the other two asymptotically conical manifolds of G2 holonomy. And in that fashion, related all of them to D brains in R6. So for this example, that was explained from a different point of view yesterday afternoon by Mina. But we're not going in that direction today. Instead, we're going to look at this example in more detail. So I've kind of explained that we have the three manifolds in M theory, and in type 2A they're related to the three familiar things that a conifold can do. And we know in type 2A that two of them are smoothly related, but M theory has a triality symmetry. So it must be that in M theory they're all smoothly related. And therefore the picture must look like this. Is there any way to get rid of the echo that the microphone is making? What? So we must have a picture like this with a Riemann surface. I've drawn it as if it has genus 0, which is the correct answer, but at the moment I've given no argument for that. There must be a smooth Riemann surface where you can smoothly interpolate between x1, x2, and x3. And I've drawn some dots, which just to warn us that there might be some singularity somewhere where something strange that we haven't talked about would happen in the physics. Just for orientation, so in the David Fest, I discussed another example where there also were three manifolds. And in that case, this was not the answer. It's harder to draw, but in that case, there were three branches that met. What's harder to draw is that these are all each meant to be Riemann surfaces, but I'm drawing lines. But the three branches were Riemann surfaces that met at a point, and they you can make transitions but one from one branch to another, but you have to go through a phase transition. Whereas in this example, the claim is that you can make a transition from one branch to another smoothly. And I've given one rather trivial argument that we know that you can go from X1 to X2 smoothly in the conformal field theory limit. And in M theory, we see that there's actually triality symmetry. Well, the goal of the rest of this talk is to make this claim about a smooth interpolation between the three more quantitative by defining natural observables and computing them. So, you know, if you think about measurements in gravity, measurements are always, okay, we don't have local operators in quantum gravity, but we can talk about the S matrix. At infinity, we know what's going on, but in the interior, fields are fluctuating in a way that's very difficult to control. So, our point of view in this work was that we'd formulate all precise definitions in terms of what was happening at infinity. There actually was a different point of view in yesterday's lecture, especially by Aganagic, where going to weak coupling for type 2A suppressed the gravitational fluctuations and made it possible to make precise statements. But here, our philosophy was that infinity is where you can make precise statements in the presence of gravity. So we defined observables that could be measured by an observer at infinity, and then we computed them. Or at least we computed them using the wonders of holomorphy. So we're going to discuss what's happening at infinity a little bit. So in Y, which is S3 times S3, but which, remember, is described by the three Gs, we define three different copies of the three sphere by saying that in the ith copy of the three sphere, all of the Gs are one except for the ith guy, and the ith guy is arbitrary. So that projects to a copy of the three sphere in Y after you divide by one by the right action of SU2. So I've defined three different S3s in Y. But since the three-dimensional homology of S3 times S3, which is Y, is only Z plus Z, these three Ds can't be linearly independent. They have to obey a linear relation. And by triality symmetry, it's obvious what the linear relation must be. D1 plus D2 plus D3 is zero. Now, one thing an observer at infinity can measure is what I'll call alpha I, which is the period over di of the C field. And because of the usual charge quantization and so on, this period is not well defined as a real number, but it's well defined as an angle. But since the sum of the three Ds is zero, alpha 1 plus alpha 2 plus alpha 3 are zero. The observer at infinity can measure three angles that will always add up to zero. Now, this is only in terms of infinity, but if you know what there is in the interior, you can say more. If you're on the ith manifold, then you've filled in the ith copy of G. The other G's live in SU2, or S3, but the ith one lives in R4. So, classically, as long as supersymmetry is unbroken, which means that C is flat, it follows that alpha I is zero on the ith manifold. Because on the ith manifold, alpha I is the period of C over di, which is the integral of dc over R4, because di is a boundary on the ith manifold. And that's zero because dc is zero. So a classical physicist, generically, by measuring alpha I at infinity, can determine which manifold xi there is in the interior. Here I've drawn, I've drawn a two-dimensional plot. See, I don't need three dimensions to plot the values of the alphas because they always add up to zero. I can plot the possible values of the alphas in a two-dimensional plot. And in this two-dimensional plot, the green lines are the lines where alpha 1 is 0, alpha 2 is 0, and alpha 3 is 0. I've actually only plotted half lines where the alphas are positive, just to make it easier to see. But mentally, if you want, continue the green lines to negative alphas. So a classical physicist would always, in measuring the alphas, land on one of the three lines, and unless one happens to land at the origin, one would then know which manifold you're on. So this picture might have suggested classically that you can make a transition from one manifold to the other only by adjusting some parameters and passing through a singularity. At any rate, you see, if this is the right state of affairs for measurements of the alphas, then it would follow that the three manifolds xi correspond to distinct branches of quantum vacua that can be distinguished by which line alpha is on. We'd have to study the origin more carefully, but away from the origin, there would be three branches. However, the claim that alpha I is 0 on xi receives corrections from membrane instantons. It's a computation I won't actually do in front of your eyes, although it's not that hard. But at any rate, what you find is that since there are membrane instanton corrections, the corrections, of course, are small if the manifold is big. When I say the manifold is big, what I really mean is that the length scale is big. The length scale is the radius of the S3 at the center. So when R is much bigger than the Planck length, membrane instantons are small, and the alphas very nearly take the values you would expect classically. But when the radius is not big, the deviations of the alphas from those values become large, and then you have to ask whether the effect of those deviations is that you can make a smooth transition from one branch to the other. Well, to get anywhere, we have to extend the alphas to holomorphic observables. So what is the superpartner of the alphas? Well, alpha is related by alpha is a mode of the C field, and supersymmetry relates C to the metric. So alpha is related by supersymmetry to modes of the metric that preserve supersymmetry, which means that they preserve G2 holonomy. In fact, if I change my notation a little bit to introduce A, B, and C like this, where they obey that A, B, and C is 1. So this is just a different set of coordinates to describe S3 times S3. If I do that, then the metric looks at infinity like this, where the V's add up to 0. If you solve the equations for G2 holonomy at infinity, you'll get the V's as 0 modes, but you'll learn that they add up to 0, just like the alphas add up to 0, and the V's are related by supersymmetry to the alphas. So V is the leading correction to a conical metric, and an observer at infinity could measure the V's by measuring the deviation of the metric from being conical. So now, certain linear combinations of the alphas combine with the alphas into holomorphic observables, which I'll call eta. I won't really explain the details, which are not complicated, but it would be too much of a distraction. So at infinity, any values of the v's that add up to 0 are allowed. But if you integrate the classical Einstein equations into the interior, classically you'll get a singularity, unless the v's obey a certain relation, which is that their ratios have to be 2 minus 1 minus 1 up to permutations. And that gives you, classically, the three branches of smooth metrics of G2 holonomy. As long as the v's are big, this classical answer is a good approximation. Because if the v's are big, then when you solve the equations, well, let's say, if you do impose this condition, you get a smooth solution whose length scale is big. But if you try to take the v's to be small, then when you integrate the equations into the interior, the corrections to the classical Einstein equations will be important. And therefore, we don't yet know what will happen. But we can sum... The v's are correction terms from the deviation from the conical metric. So to answer your question, I need to know how you want to relate it to the three form. Could we post... I'd like to at least say the minimum so that the rest of the lecture will be clear. So if the v's are big, the classical Einstein equations are a good approximation. If the v's are not big, they're not. You can always measure... Well, if the V's are, first of all, at infinity, everything is going to be fine anyway. So at infinity, the classical Einstein equations are always a good approximation, even if the length scale is small in the interior. So a classical physicist solves the Einstein equations, understands that the V's are the possible parameters, and then goes out there with rulers and measuring sticks and measures the V's. I don't know precisely what relation you have in mind. And because of the large variation in knowledge about G2 manifolds, I'd prefer to postpone the question unless it's needed. Okay. So to summarize what we know now, though, we have some exact statements that are true without using classical geometry. The exact statements are that the alphas add up to zero, and the V's add up to zero, and therefore the product of the eta's is one. That's exact. Now, if we're willing to use classical geometry, that means whenever the length scale is big, then we have the fact that in the supergravity approximation, alpha is zero, and also the corresponding V tilde is zero, and therefore eta is one on Xi. So that's only in the supergravity approximation, so it means it's only true in the limit where the volume of Xi goes to infinity. Volume means the volume of the three sphere in the interior. So a picture is going to be that there's a moduli space we're trying to find. And we already, I've drawn it as if it has genus zero, which we don't know yet, but we do know that it smoothly connects the three branches. And they're going to be points where the x's appear. What it means for x to appear is that it appears with its volume going to infinity. Because it only makes sense to talk about a classical manifold when its volume does go to infinity. When the volume is Planckian, the classical notions aren't valid. And we can't necessarily distinguish the manifolds. So the assertion is that eta 1 is 1 at this point, eta 2 is 1 at this point, and eta 3 is 1 at this point, and the product of the three etas is 1 everywhere. Now, it's also true, you see, as you approach the point x1, the volume going to infinity means that the v's go to infinity. In that limit, 2 minus 1, in that ratio, 2 minus 1 minus 1, that's needed in order to get a smooth solution everywhere of the Einstein equations. And when the v's go to infinity, the eta's, some of these go to infinity, some go to minus infinity. So eta might go to either infinity or zero. So some etas have poles and some have zeros at these three points. And there's a little bit of argument that I'm not going to give now to determine precisely the order of the zero and the poles. But when you do it, you find that at the point xi, that means at the point on the moduli space where one sees the classical manifold xi in its large volume limit, it turns out that not only is one of the etas one, which I've already explained, but one of them has a pole and one of them has a zero. If you want to know which is which appears to break the symmetry that exchanges the other two, I made an arbitrary sign convention in defining these etas. So having picked my sign convention, one has a zero and one has a pole, but it would have been equally natural to replace them all by their inverses. But with the particular convention, we get this result. So I won't carefully show you that one has a simple pole and one has a simple zero, but the assertion comes by examining the classical metric of x to see that one v tilde, a superpartner of alpha, is proportional to the volume and one is proportional to minus the volume. Now, it's reasonable to think that any point on the moduli space where some of the v's go to plus or minus infinity, and therefore some etas have zeros or poles, can be visible classically. You see, this observer at infinity with those yardsticks and so on measures some of the v's to be thousands of kilometers and says, well, oh ho, there's a very big length scale in this problem. The wonders of quantum gravity have lifted somewhat, and we should be able to understand semi-classically what's going on in the interior, which has produced this huge length scale. So it's reasonable to believe that we can see classically all zeros are poles of the Eta's. And the most optimistic assumption we can make, it turns out that in a later generalization that I'll just briefly mention at the end, this would be too optimistic, but the most we could hope for is that the zeros and poles all correspond to classical solutions that we already know about. So, well, actually I shouldn't have changed notation. My notation was that the points on the moduli space corresponding to xi, I just call it xi, but anyway. You see, here's a table of the behavior of the Eta's at the three points on the moduli space. And each, so x1, the point x1 I've called p1 here in this table. At any rate, each Eta has one pole and one zero, and there's one point where it's one. Well, we can now get a consistent story, assuming that the only semi-classical limits are the ones we know about, because each Eta has the same number of zeros and poles. Since there's a function with only one zero and one pole, namely any of the Eta's, the moduli space has genus zero. And we could regard the moduli space as the Eta 1 plane, or the Eta 2 plane, or the Eta 3 plane, because if it has one zero and one pole, it takes every value exactly once. And the moduli space is the Eta 1 plane. The only reason not to do that is that that would mess up the triality symmetry. So to preserve the triality symmetry, I regard the moduli space as the complex T plane, with the P's being the cube roots of 1, and triality acts by the permutations of the cube roots of 1, which in terms of T are this. And then I've got these claims about the behavior of Eta's at the cube roots of 1, and they have a unique solution. So this is our answer for the moduli space. Now, there's an interesting generalization about this problem that's really unresolved, but I want to mention it, which is that it was membrane instantons wrapped on the S3 in R4 times S3, which is our G2 manifold, that modified the classical statement that Eta is 1 on Xi, and therefore made it possible for this smooth interpolation to exist. The same membrane instantons, by almost the same calculation, also generate a superpotential, whose meaning is rather esoteric in the situation I've described, because the parameter T is a coupling constant rather than a modulus, rather than a field. But we could make T dynamical if we would embed all this in a compact manifold of G2 on ME. In that case, W of T would actually be a physical superpotential for the field T. And it would have the usual consequence of lifting the vacuum degeneracy. The vacuum would land at a critical point of T. Of W, I mean. But unfortunately, at least from this point of view, I don't know what W is. One simple thing I can say is that it has zeros at the points PI. It comes from membrane instanton effects. So it has, since it has three zeros, it has at least three poles. And if there are precisely three poles, then we can determine what it is using the triality symmetry. It's very interesting that it has poles, because you think that the poles mean something. Just to give you an analogy, for type 2A, there was the conformal field theory of the conifold, and the Yukawa coupling was studied in the early 90s, and had a pole. And that pole turned out to be a sign of new physics at that point, namely the conifold transition. So it seems to me that the poles of the superpotential might similarly be signs of something we don't know. That's interesting. In fact, there was some discussion of this at the David Fest when I wrote down this formula. So I might emphasize now that the fact that the moduli space has just one branch containing all the singular points, so that you can interpolate between them without a phase transition, actually follows from our table, because this table makes sense because Eta has the same number of zeros and poles. But obviously, if we claimed that the P's were on different branches, we'd then have Eta 1, for example, having its poles and zeros in different branches, which wouldn't make sense. Now, this story has a fascinating generalization that was discussed in previous lectures. And although there isn't time to systematically explain it, I'm going to spend just a few minutes to at least give a hint of what happens when one studies it from this point of view. So in this story, you replace xi by xi over gamma. Well, gamma is an ADE subgroup of, say, the first SU2. We could look at more general gammas, but this case is already interesting. So at infinity, we replace y by y over gamma. And then we look for manifolds of D2 holonomy that are asymptotic to y over gamma, to a cone on y over gamma. And there are three of them, namely xi over gamma, at the classical level. But they have a difference, which has already been explained again, but which I'm going to briefly review. So we're taking gamma to act on just G1. Now, on two of the manifolds, we filled in G2 or G3, and then we gauge away the other one. It doesn't matter which is which. So if, for example, we filled in G2, which lives in R4, and we gauged away G3, then, you see, G1 lives in S3, but we've divided it by gamma, so, and G2 lives in R4. So our manifold is S3 over gamma times R4. That's a smooth manifold, because gamma, the finite subgroup of SU2, is acting on the left on S3, regarded as SU2, it acts freely. If, however, we filled in G1, so G1 lives in R4, and, for example, G2 lives in S3, and we gauged away G3, then when we divide by gamma, we get S3 times R4 over gamma. And now, as Acharya explained in the last lecture, the R4 over gamma, depending on gamma, gives ADE gauge symmetry, living on the S3, but it's not just S3, it's S3 times four-dimensional Minkowski space, which I've suppressed through the lecture. But since S3 is compact and smooth and simply connected and all that, it doesn't give any zero modes of gauge fields. The low energy physics is just ADE gauge symmetry on Minkowski four space. Now, X2 over gamma and X3 over gamma are smooth, so a mask in the effective four-dimensional physics is clear in those cases. On the other hand, X1 over gamma leads to four-dimensional ADE gauge theory. So, if you have a smooth interpolation between them, that implies that there's a mass gap in the gauge theory. It also implies confinement, as Acharya explained, and chiral symmetry breaking, as was argued by Atiyah Madhusena and Vapa. And, well, I won't have time to explain it, but I'll just briefly mention it in a moment. Now, the strategy, the same strategy I used to get the interpolation among the xi, also proves the existence of a smooth interpolation between the xi over gamma, but many new details come in, some of which involve subtleties of this formalism, but others actually involve new bits of physics. So one thing is that to get the zeros and poles to match up, you need to take into account chiral symmetry breaking. So in fact, if the gauge group is SUM, that's, well, that's the only interesting thing that is new. There are some uninteresting details you have to get straight. And then after getting those straight and also taking into account chiral symmetry breaking, it works. So working means that we get the same kind of moduli space I told you with X1 over gamma, X2 over gamma, and X3 over gamma. But we have to take into account the classical geometry and a variety of technical details, but most interestingly, the chiral symmetry breaking, in order to get a consistent picture. Well, if for the other gauge groups, Dn and also E6, E7, and E8, we have some more fun. So here I've drawn it for D. And it turns out that for D, there really are four classical limits. So there's X2 over gamma and X3 over gamma, but X1 over gamma appears twice. I've called the second one X1 over gamma tilde. x1 over gamma in the classical limit has SO2n gauge symmetry, but the other fellow has SPn minus 4 gauge symmetry. So, well, this picture implies, since there's obviously a mass gap here, that both the SO2n and SPn minus 4 gauge theories have a mass gap so that they could all be in the same universality class. That's a special case of what it implies. So the point is that there are two different kinds of DN singularity in M theory, which are related in type 2A to the two kinds of Orientifold 6 plane. You could take an O6 minus plane with N D brain pairs, and then the gauge group is SO2N. You can take an O6 plus plane with N minus 4 pairs, giving SPN minus 4. The reason I chose the 4 is that the 4 is needed so that the Ramond-Ramond flux of the two, or D-brain charge, is the same. Since the D-brain charge is the same, the fields at infinity are the same, and when you lift it up to M theory, they look the same. They both lift up to the same thing in M theory, which is a DN singularity. As far as the metric is concerned, they differ by the flux, the periods of the C field. So there are the two things that classically look the same in M theory. And in building up this picture for DN, both of them appear. So you see, in type 2A, you have the two O6 planes. You could ask, can you continuously connect from one to another by going through a region where the coupling constant is strong? The answer is no, if you don't compactify, because they have different gauge groups. And in seven dimensions, the gauge group is an observable feature of the low-energy physics. But if you compactify three or more dimensions, you get to gauge theory in four or fewer dimensions, which has strong infrared interactions, and where the gauge group may not be an observable feature of low-energy physics because of confinement and the mass gap and all that fun stuff. And that actually happens here. The O6 minus or O6 plus planes wrapped on a three sphere can be continuously connected to each other, and in fact are in the story. So if that happens for D, what happens for E6, 7, and 8? Well, there's a more elaborate story that I'll just give you a hint of. So the point is that there are many kinds of E6, E7, or E8 singularities in M theory, which were analyzed in a recent seven-author paper of Morris and Sethi et al. My apologies to the authors for not providing a proper list here. So, for example, the most familiar E8 singularity in M theory has gauge group E8. But there are about 11 other kinds of E8 singularity in M theory whose gauge group is F4, G2, SU2, or nothing. And they all appear in this story so that the M theory curve interpolates between a lot of different limits. I forgot to draw x2 over gamma and x3 over gamma. And in addition to those two, there are 12 more limits where E8 and F4 appear once each, G2 and SU2 appear twice each, I think. And nothing appears a lot of times. So nothing means that there's a classical limit where the volume becomes big and the geometry macroscopically looks like R4 over gamma E8 times a three sphere. But there are some fields near the origin, near the singularity, such that it doesn't produce any gauge symmetry. Well, they differ not just near the origin, they differ at infinity. The different possible versions of the R4 over gamma singularity for given gamma differ by a period that can be measured at infinity of the C field over S3 mod gamma. And that period for D can be 0 or half. And for E6 and E7, it has values investigated by in the seven-author paper. And for E8, I've listed them here. They're related to the Chern-Simons invariance of flat E8 connections on the three torus. So, turns out, if you include all the possible versions of the R4 mod gamma singularity, and you also take account of chiral symmetry breaking, and a number of other technical details that come in, then the zeros and poles match up and you get a unique solution for the moduli space. Okay, the organizers asked us to state a vision for the future, but a little bit of prudence tells me not to. I remember what would have happened if I'd been asked to do that in 1990, let's say 10 years ago. So I would have been lucky if not pressed. If I'd merely, I could have stated just one or two wrong ideas if I'd been left to my own. But if pressed, I could perhaps have come up with 20 of them. So I think prudence tells me to stop here. However, it's been fun to listen to other people's suggestions about the future.
Any questions? And a fair question is for Ed to name some of his wrong ideas for future tests.
For example, the E8 singularity case that you just described with these 12 classical limits plus the two, with these 14 classical limits, the points with G2 gauge group and SU2 and F4 so on, are those limits where the low energy dynamics is actually G2 super Yang mills or not?
Well, it depends on what scale. It's the same as it was in your lecture. So in a limit where the S3 is big, down to exponentially low distances, it can be described in terms of G2 gauge theory. And then at even longer distances, G2 gets more strongly coupled and eventually, presumably, confines and generates a mass gap. In fact, the fact that it has a mass gap is kind of inherent in this picture, which wouldn't make sense otherwise. But you see G2 gauge symmetry to the same extent, in exactly the same sense that one sees the SUN gauge symmetry that you were mentioning. The answer I would give to your question is exactly the same as the answer you gave to mine, in essence.
So the number of vacua are the dual Coxon number for n equals yes. 1 Yang mills. How do you reconcile this with this picture of having these different C2s in the same picture? The number of vacua jumps as you move around?
Well, there are a variety of technicalities I haven't explained. So, and there isn't time to explain all of them. You need to consider the different guys. I can give you only a very naive version of it, which has a lot of things omitted. But one thing that comes out that you pointed out in your paper is that, well, you have S3 mod gamma. So that's going to cause some poles to be of order gamma. And then there's going to be zeros that are affected by chiral symmetry breaking. And those will be of order H, where H is the dual Coxeter number. So if H is the number of elements in gamma, then all would be sweetness and light. And that's what happens for SUN. But it doesn't work for D and E, which actually is a fact that had a big influence in my work. Because in the early 80s, when I was trying to understand trace minus 1 to the F for gauge theories, for essentially the same reason, it didn't work for D and E. So I stopped working on symmetric dynamics. But as we now know, you have to take account of these other components in that problem. And the same thing happens again here. So the sum rule that doesn't work for the groups other than SUN works if you include all the different components. Well, there's something I'm trying to avoid telling you, but it's hard. But there's a very important detail that is needed even to make sense of SUN, which is that this curve parameterizes a pair consisting of a theory and a vacuum. You can't make sense of first parameterizing the theories and then the vacua. I think I'd, in a sense, prefer to discuss that privately because it's quite a subtle story. But even for SUN, there's a delicate story to make sense of this. And when one does that, then for the other groups, the only thing that goes wrong is this, and you fix it by including the different components. Yes?
So you mentioned that you're in the infinite volume limit where the gauge coupling, or the parameter that we think of as corresponding to the gauge coupling, is not really dynamical.
Yes.
If you put these things into a compact context, do you think that the metric on moduli space would keep all of the distances in your different tubes finite, or do you think that the metric might have interior features that include regions that are driven off to infinite distance just by the behavior of the Kähler metric?
Well, I'm not sure I completely understand the question, but suppose the G2 manifold is very big, like meters or kilometers. So this is an extremely good approximation. The main deviation from what I've told you is that since the field is dynamical, there is a non-zero potential, because there's a non-zero superpotential. So the vacua, first of all, vacua becomes then the right terminology rather than theories, because T parameterizes now a family of vacua. But they're not all vacua because they're not degenerate because of the superpotential. So it becomes important to know what the superpotential is. It's probably very closely related to what you heard about yesterday from Vafa and Aganagic, but unfortunately, I don't understand the relation exactly. Because, for example, in this context, I can't see the meaning of the classical term they talked about.
Well, could I extend the question a little bit? What I'm trying to ask is, do you think there's a meaningful sense, if you compactify, in which the different tubes really are connected in one big moduli space, or do you think that you can talk about approximate vacua far down each tube, but that there's no real sense in which they're
connected? No, I think that, well, I wouldn't have been so interested in the problem, except that I believe the answer carries over to the case of a compact manifold. The reason I believe it carries over is that everything is an extremely good approximation if the size of the manifold is meters or kilometers. What I think is the main difference is, first, that the degeneracy will be lifted because of the superpotential. And secondly, you would think that there is some really interesting new physics at the poles of the superpotential.
The superpotential can be thought of as a sum of membrane instantons.
Yes.
So from this you can extract a multiple cover formula for n times.
Well, I didn't claim to determine the superpotential.
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't. I said what it was if it only has three poles.
Then I misunderstood you, but...
But maybe the formula with only three poles is correct. In any event, I determined it as a function of, assuming it has three poles, as a function of a parameter I defined at infinity. And you see, if one's going to ask for such a formula, you need a precise explanation of what your parameter makes sense, or what your parameter means. And that's usually given by special coordinates with n equals 2 supersymmetry.
Yes,
and
right.
What was done in yesterday's lectures was to relate this to weakly coupled type 2a, where since, for some points of view, the effects of the D-brains in Riemann 1 fields are small, you can borrow the type 2a coordinates.
Okay, and
but
if you do
here,
that,
this is
that, then you get a multiple cover formula of 1 over n squared. My question was actually a little bit different, which was, do you think that there should be a multiple cover formula for general membrane instantons?
Well, this is what I'm trying to tell you. Before we get an answer, we have to have a question. And we don't have a question until we've explained how to define the parameter. So it can't be more general than the question, and you have to tell me your general definition of the parameter to have a question. See, I had a very special definition of the parameter having to do with the behavior at infinity.
Yeah, so if I use such a definition, then I would imagine that superpotential is a sum over such membrane instantons.
Well, for this problem, the superpotential is a sum over multi-wrappings.
Right.
And if you believe the formula with only three poles, then that's the answer. But when you ask for a general formula, I need to know in general, in whatever generality you have in mind, how you're going to define the parameter in terms of which you want to express the superpotential.
In terms of that parameter, which is physical, you want to ask what's doing. And that's, in fact, the sense in which the aggregation might compute.
Well, that's very tricky in M-theory. Because, well, maybe it's something we should discuss separately.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.